is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Israeli forces shoot and kill a Palestinian man during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Yemeni officials warn about an increasing number of infants with birth defects due to the use of banned weapons. By the Saudi coalition will have a report from Sana'a. Search and rescue operations are underway in southern and central U.S. following dozens of tornadoes that left more than 100 people dead. Welcome. Israeli troops have killed a Palestinian during a raid on the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces claim they opened fire after Palestinians hurled explosive devices at them. One Palestinian later succumbed to the wounds he sustained during the Israeli live fire. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement issued a statement expressing condolences to the family of the victim. Time and again, Israeli forces target Palestinians with live rounds while raiding their cities and town in the occupied territories. In recent months, Israeli forces have shot dead many Palestinians, voicing their anger at Israeli atrocities, as well as the demolition of their ancestral homes as part of the regime's expansionist agenda. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli regime uses excessive force against Palestinians without any particular reason.
Human rights organizations accuse the Israeli forces of using excessive force, of using shooting in order to kill against the Palestinians. It's not about only arresting people, those who are claimed by the Israeli military to be wanted for any reason, but in case Palestinians threw even rocks and stones in order to force the military to be out of the areas, then the Israeli forces' option would be using live ammunition and killing people in cold blood.
Four people are killed and several injured in a shooting in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has blamed the shooting on the Palestinian Authority's security forces in Lebanon. Hamas said the killings targeted the entire Palestinian community in Lebanon. The group noted that the incident severed, or I should say, served the Israeli interest by undermining the security of Lebanon's sensitive south. The deadly shooting took place during a funeral procession held for one of Hamas members in Burj al-Shamali camp. that was killed in an explosion on Friday, which Hamas says was caused by an electrical fault in a warehouse. Yemeni health officials are warning about an increasing number of infants with birth defects. They say the use of internationally prohibited weapons by the Saudi-led coalition has dramatically pushed up cases of congenital anomalies. Our correspondent in Sana'a reports.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hodeida, Hajja, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering a difficult condition in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Al-Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok has replaced all acting state governors appointed by the country's military leader following the October coup. Hamdok has also replaced most of the caretaker deputy ministers appointed by the military. The prime minister is yet to name a cabinet of technocrats as stipulated by the November 21st deal he signed with the military. The deal was reached after mass protests against the military and a wide international condemnation of the coup, which upended the transition towards the civilian government. In Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi is using its anti-terror law against civil society members, journalists, and civilians to stifle dissent in the region. The Indian security apparatus is keeping a close watch on social media activities of locals in Kashmir and uses this data as evidence to label people as nationalist or anti-nationalist. Our correspondent Shahanabad reports.
The death of India's Chief of Defense Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the chief of defense staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake, since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party, Bharatiya Janata Party, came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
U.S. emergency workers are searching for survivors after a string of tornadoes killed dozens of people across six states. Authorities say there is little chance of finding survivors 2 days after the tornadoes hit Midwestern U.S. Kentucky is the hardest hit, with a death toll of more than 80 people. Many of them were workers at a candle factory in the ravaged town of Mayfield. The state governor says bodies are still found, warning that the number could exceed 100. Relief efforts are also underway in Kentucky, supplying those affected with shelters and food. More aid will be delivered to the state as President Joe Biden has declared a major federal disaster in Kentucky. Thousands of homes and buildings have been destroyed there. Twisters have also killed several people in the states of Tennessee, Missouri, and Arkansas.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I was like, I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he's described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm during his career spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night and I was saying, wait a second, this is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. are fast approaching the 800,000 mark despite a widespread vaccination process. That's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Other tallies suggest the country's coronavirus-related fatalities have already surpassed 800,000. The last 100,000 deaths were recorded in a matter of 73 days. The United States is the world's worst-hit nation, both in terms of deaths and infections. Meanwhile, American politicians are scrambling to push for more vaccinations amid fears of the spread of the new Omicron variant. Over 70% of the U.S. population has been partially vaccinated. Still, the country has seen more deaths this year than in 2020. Finally, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls to step down amid a series of scandals that have already taken their toll on the popularity of his Conservative Party. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest in 3 years following those scandals, including one involving a Downing Street party that was held during last year's lockdowns. Let's watch this report to understand more.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about two more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister, okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
Many thanks for staying tuned. Have a good day.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not,
and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
The limelight.
Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in U.S. government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. This opinion article has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, "We Can Live Better Lives While Being Smart About COVID." Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in the U.S. government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. It is past time to ask ourselves, as another COVID winter begins, if we have to keep living like this, anxious over the unknown, worried about large indoor gatherings, tense at every bit of virus news, and frustrated, and at times contemptuous of fellow Americans who have a dramatically different sense of acceptable risk. Because progress has been made this year, vaccines that protect against serious illness and death are taking ever greater hold in the United States and are beginning to make their way into the world's most vulnerable regions. Drugs that work against the virus are coming through the pipeline, and despite a recent uptick in cases, schools and businesses remain open. Americans should pause a moment and let this progress sink in. The virus will continue to surprise us, and even when scientists manage to predict its worst turns, officials will not necessarily be able to prevent those turns from coming. But what if leaders at all levels made choices so that we don't have to exhaust ourselves with stress over every curveball? To help us all live more normally with this virus rather than let it control us. That exhaustion has characterized so much of the past 2 years, as parents, teachers, frontline healthcare workers, and small business owners wade through what can feel like an unending morass. Is it safe to celebrate the holidays? Will schools shut down again? When will young children finally be eligible for vaccines? And why are we still having to ask ourselves these questions? It is too soon to say how long the current surge will last or how it might be shaped by the Omicron variant. But even amid that uncertainty, we should push for a more pragmatic path from our decision makers that will help us protect ourselves and live more normal lives, even as the virus continues to evolve. make coronavirus testing as fast, easy, and inexpensive as possible. Ubiquitous testing could help schools stay open and make gatherings of every kind safer. With more than 1,000 people still dying of COVID-19 every day in the United States, it's past time to make this basic tool as readily available as it is in other countries like in South Korea or Britain. President Biden's latest plan, which would require people with private health insurance to submit a claim for reimbursement and people without health insurance or private coverage to hunt down free tests at community health centers, does not do nearly enough to achieve that goal. Instead, the Biden administration should do what other countries have done and what the United States did so successfully with vaccines. Work directly with companies to get more tests approved and on the market quickly. Use advanced purchasing agreements to ensure a steady supply of those tests and create federal subsidies for clinics and pharmacies to provide them free or very cheap to consumers who want them. Aim to make the 2021-2022 school year the last dominated by COVID. The Biden administration should have enough testing free and available and push to have a critical mass of students vaccinated by September. Quarantine and isolation policies will also need an upgrade. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, still advises people to isolate for 10 days after experiencing symptoms or testing positive, regardless of their vaccination status. Many schools still require anyone who's been in contact with an infected person to quarantine for several days, at least. As breakthrough infections become more common, even among those who have received their booster shots, it makes sense to allow workers and students to avoid confinement or test their way out of it much more quickly. Wearing face masks in schools is uniquely challenging. No one wants to force young children to wear face masks for several hours a day indefinitely, but it would also be foolish to abandon the practice completely. A happy medium may be to require face masks for students during surges or when new variants of concern are detected and vaccine escape is still being measured. The rest of the time, evidence so far suggests the requirement could be lifted. Nevada has successfully tied its school masking mandates to community transmission rates, and experts say it is worth trying the same in other states as well. We must all prepare for surges. No scientist or health official has managed to predict or even explain after the fact what constellation of forces causes the pandemic to ebb and flow around the globe the way it has. But it's clear that there will continue to be periods of substantial uptick in coronavirus cases, and there should be sensible, significantly better policies in place for dealing with them. Country-specific travel bans are futile. By the time a variant like Omicron is detected in one country, it's already spread halfway around the globe. Penalizing countries that report new variants, as South Africa did with Omicron variant, will only discourage them from sharing that kind of information in the future. Blanket policies, like requiring everyone entering the United States to test negative or possibly quarantine, would be tougher and more expensive to carry out. It would also have a better chance of actually working. If federal officials are serious about using border control to slow the spread of dangerous pathogens, they will need to establish clear, enforceable test and quarantine protocols, not to mention adequate quarantine facilities at ports of entry. Do away with COVID theater. The coronavirus is airborne, and any money spent on deep cleaning would be better put towards improved building ventilation. But instead of upgrading their HVAC systems, too many schools and businesses are still relying on things that won't work nearly as well. The plastic barriers that have become common in restaurants Nail salons and offices, for example, can actually impede airflow and exacerbate viral spread. Lawmakers and local officials should make a concerted effort to change that. Not only would improved ventilation help thwart coronavirus, it would also curb the spread of other airborne pathogens, including the flu and those that cause the common cold. Keep going on vaccines. Public health powers were once a common feature of American life, when cholera and yellow fever routinely stalked the nation's major cities. Citizens accepted and expected their health departments to issue mandates, quarantine orders, and travel restrictions. It's crucial for officials to shore up those powers now, because scientists say the epidemics and pandemics will only become more common in the years ahead. President Biden's vaccine mandates have been bold and effective, and administration officials should stay the course no matter how many legal battles they encounter. In the meantime, government officials and private businesses would do well to stand firm on some basics. COVID vaccines should be required for public employees and in large companies, for healthcare workers, in schools, for staff, as well as for students for whom the vaccine shots are authorized, and for a range of indoor activities, including dining in restaurants and attending concerts. Face masks should be worn again in indoor public settings anytime transmission rates are high, vaccination rates are low, or new variants of concern are circulating. Even as we remain vigilant against the coronavirus, we need not remain in a state of paralyzing hypervigilance. Returning to the sound basics of public health, continuing the progress of medical innovation, and ratcheting back the societal anxiety around the pandemic could make us all a lot healthier.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the people, and the region as a whole. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Bangladesh's growing clout 50 years after its independence and how major world powers are vying for its attention. And we shall look at recent events in India's industrial city of Gurgaon, where open spaces are shrinking for Muslims to pray amid attacks by Hindus.
The remarkable economic growth of Bangladesh in recent years has captured global attention, with the world's two largest economic powers wooing Dhaka. China has been making deep inroads in the South Asian country, investing massively in its infrastructure, much to the chagrin of Washington. On the other hand, the US has been making efforts to rope Bangladesh into the Quad Alliance in order to counterbalance the growing Chinese power in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, the question is, will the dragon prevail over the eagle, or vice versa? Only time will tell.
Bangladesh's growth story 50 years since its independence has been a much touted one. The South Asian country, bordering the Bay of Bengal, is projected to have the world's 28th largest economy by 2030. This impressive outlook, coupled with its strategic location, has earned the country attention from global and regional powers. Bangladesh figures prominently in the US-China rivalry to win allies in the Indo-Pacific region, with gradual shift of focus towards the Indian Ocean and its littoral states. Bangladesh's location provides a significant strategic value for both Beijing and Washington. China's friendship with Bangladesh dates back to the Defense Cooperation Pact signed in December 2002, which was later upgraded to strategic partnership during Chinese president's visit to Dhaka in 2016. Today, Beijing is the largest trading partner for Dhaka, and most of its defense purchases also originate from China. The deepening economic and security cooperation between the two countries, however, has caused jitters in faraway Washington. In a bid to counter growing Chinese influence in the Indo-Pacific region, United States has been courting Bangladesh to join the Quad Alliance, which Beijing calls a Cold War construct. Chinese envoy to Dhaka recently cautioned Dhaka against falling into the trap, warning that it could substantially damage their relations. It remains to be seen who will prevail, dragon or the eagle.
India played the central role in Bangladesh's liberation war in 1971, which continues to nourish their long-lasting ties. But with the region's geopolitical tectonic shifts, not everything has remained hunky-dory between the two close neighbors. It appears that Bangladesh has finally come out of the shadow of India. Its growing engagement with Beijing amid the China-India tug-of-war for regional influence has worried New Delhi. Plus, the Modi government's Hindu nationalist politics has also contributed to the tensions between the two countries.
For long, Bangladesh lurked under the shadow of India, which was once touted as one of the fastest-growing economies. But in recent years, tables have turned with Bangladesh outpacing its big neighbor on many fiscal, economic, and social indicators. On the other hand, it has completely surpassed Pakistan, from which it broke off in 1971. Bangladesh's growing political and financial clout means it has got new friends and allies, most notably China. The growing engagement between Bangladesh and China is being seen with concern in New Delhi, which has a long-running rivalry with Beijing. Considering its age-old rivalry with Pakistan and signs that traditional allies Sri Lanka and Nepal are also being courted by China, New Delhi fears that Bangladesh too might move into the Chinese orbit. Bangladesh borders India along the latter seven northeastern states, which are mostly restive. In the same region, China also borders India and claims one of Indian states, Arunachal Pradesh. Any tensions or military confrontation between India and China is likely to affect Bangladesh. Relations between New Delhi and Dhaka have also experienced bumps due to Narendra Modi's government's Hindu supremacist politics. Bangladeshi Prime Minister and others have suggested that the anti-Muslim outlook of Modi government has contributed to violence against Hindus in Bangladesh.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Tunç Akoç, a journalist and a political analyst. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Akoç. And let's begin by talking about Bangladesh's economic rise and social mobilization in recent years, which has led to shifts in its foreign policy. Now, how do you see its relations with major world powers today?
Hello and greetings from Turkey, from Istanbul. Well, Bangladesh has a balanced relationship with both the superpowers and its neighbors. It has historically friendly relations with India, and in recent years, Bangladesh established strong economic relations with China, and they become strategic partners. Bangladesh also tries to keep good relations with the United States, the country to which it exports the most. But I think it is not easy to maintain this balance policy. Actually, it depends on the economic development of the country. Bangladesh can become an important actor in the region if it continues to grow its economic power. I think the relations with especially China and India will be good in the future, but the relations with the United States will worsen. As you know, Joe Biden did not invite Bangladesh to the Democracy Summit, just as he did not invite China or Russia or Turkey, Hungary, Iran, Azerbaijan, etc. I mean, the contradiction is this. In Bangladesh, there is strong female labor participation in the economy, or the country has been a significant global player in efforts to fight extremism and climate change. So the reason why Bangladesh was not invited is, I think, obvious. The United States of America is uncomfortable with Bangladesh's geopolitical choices. And we can say, in a sense, Joe Biden punished the country for that reason. Finally, I think the upcoming elections are crucial for Bangladesh's future. And if Mrs. Sheikh Hasina's line wins, the current policies will remain.
So regional rivals China and India are Bangladesh's two biggest trade partners. Does that put Dhaka at the risk of becoming embroiled in the China-India tug-of-war for regional supremacy?
No, I don't think so. These are, I think, two separate and non-contrasting realities for Bangladesh. The first one, of course, currently there are 9 projects running under the Belt and Road Initiative in Bangladesh, including the mega project of the Padma Bridge Railway. And Bangladesh also occupies a strategic position along the Maritime Silk Road, with its port, of Chittagong as a major maritime hub through the Indian Ocean. And as we know, China is the top direct foreign investor in Bangladesh. And on the other side, Bangladesh has very strong political and also cultural links with India. And meanwhile, it's geographically almost entirely surrounded by India. And I think Bangladesh's location between China and India, because of that reason, Bangladesh is a prime candidate I think, to emerge as a trading and manufacturing hub, you know. And based on this vision, I would say the tensions between China and India will not escalate to the point where the region would be destabilized.
Mr. Akoc, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Jeff Smith, author and research scholar, cites Chinese envoy to Bangladesh Li Jiming, warning that China-Bangladesh relations will suffer if Dhaka joins the US-led Quad alliance. India's foreign ministry spokesman Arindam Bagchi facilitates Bangladesh on its 50th independence anniversary, recalling that India was one of the first countries to recognize Dhaka. Qazi Fahim Ahmed, Dhaka-based columnist, quotes from an article saying US must not see Bangladesh through India's prism, which he warns will affect US Indo-Pacific strategy.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India's industrial city of Gurgaon has witnessed communal tensions in recent weeks, with the minority Muslims accusing the right-wing Hindu extremist groups of not allowing them to perform Friday prayers in designated open spaces. Previously, there were over 100 open spaces where local Muslims had the administration's permission to perform prayers, but the number has now dropped to only 20. And what is worse is that the civilian and police administration has failed to rein in these extremist groups and safeguard the rights of Muslims.
Since 2018, intermittent protests by extremist Hindu groups against minority Muslims offering congressional Friday prayers in open spaces in the city of Gurgaon, 30 kilometers south of capital New Delhi, have led to clashes and violence. It has also shrunk the number of open spaces earmarked for Muslims to pray from more than 100 to 20 or even less. A few weeks ago, members of right-wing groups again began to disrupt Friday prayers in the city known as the industrial and technological hub of India. The city has about 500,000 Muslim population. In a provocative move, trucks were parked in the area designated for prayers. When Muslims protested, the administration buckled under the pressure of extremist Hindu groups. Pertinently, last month, an umbrella organization of Hindu groups called Sangyukt Hindu Sanghar Samiti had warned to use weapons and go to jail if the Muslim prayers were not stopped. Now they have vowed to keep protesting until no more open spaces are left for Muslims to pray. Local Muslim groups believe it is a deliberate attempt to disturb peace and communal harmony. They have taken up the matter to higher authorities, but without any luck so far.
The recent events in Gurgaon did not happen in a vacuum. The seeds of Hindu-Muslim tensions were sown soon after the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India in 2014. The party has been accused of pursuing the majoritarian agenda and fanning the flames of violence against vulnerable Muslims across the country. By silencing progressive voices and othering the minority communities, the Modi government has empowered Hindu supremacist vigilante groups. This policy polarizes Hindu voters against Muslims and brings election victories for the BJP.
Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has managed to create a sense of Hindu victimhood stoking sentiments against Muslims in a country where Hindus are a whopping 85%, while Muslims are barely 14%. By empowering Hindu vigilante groups and refusing to provide justice to Muslim victims, the government has allowed religious divisions to deepen further. Under the Modi government, mob lynching and hate crimes have assumed alarming proportions, while marginalization of Muslims has become a part of the ecosystem. Social media is replete with videos of self-appointed Hindutva champions calling for lynching of Muslims for crimes ranging from offering prayers in open to eating meat. Sometimes the provocation is simply the Muslim identity. Violence against Muslims has been normalized to the extent that Hindu groups in India now attack mosques and ransack homes if anti-Hindu riots are reported in other countries. The incidents in Gurgaon came weeks after Hindus went on a rampage against Muslims in the Indian state of Tripura. There have also been protests and threats to remove street vendors selling meat-based snacks in several cities of India's Gujarat state, which shows that religious minorities in India are being denied equal access in public spaces. That's the India of today Mahatma Gandhi would definitely not be proud of.
Now, to have more insight, I'd like to welcome Mr. Ahmad Hussain to the program, the spokesperson for Muslim Public Affairs Committee, UK. Now, Mr. Hussain, open places of worship for Muslims are rapidly shrinking in India's industrial city, Gurgaon, as right-wing Hindus have been campaigning against it. So what is driving this frenzy?
Firstly, thank you for having me. So what's going on in Gurgaon? We've got a city of 1.5 million people, and it barely has 20 mosques. For comparison, if we look at the English city of Birmingham with 1.1 million inhabitants and has over 200 mosques, we can see that there's clearly a need for these large public open spaces to be used by Muslims, because Hindu supremacists have already ensured that there aren't enough mosque spaces. So this current frenzy is being fed by people who just want to continue making life difficult for Muslims. And who's driving this frenzy? It's organized Hindu supremacists, groups like the RSS, who want to see a greater Hindu-only India as some kind of a mythical solution for modern India's problems.
So why are the authorities in Gurgaon and other Indian cities caving in to the pressure of extremist Hindu groups rather than standing up to them and protecting the rights of the minority Muslims?
So to understand what the Gurgaon authorities are doing and are going to do, we have to look at the political context. So Gurgaon, the area, was generally a Congress seat until the 2014, when it flipped to the BJP, and in 2019 the BJP grew their voter share there. So the Gurgaon authorities' priorities are going to be the BJP's priorities, and the BJP is basically, simply put, a manifestation of the RSS's Hindu supremacist grassroots. And when you look at the words of the leaders and the politicians of the BJP, and this isn't something that they try to hide, they openly call for the genocide of Muslims. So these supremacists are the voter base of the BJP. So the BJP has a vested interest in instigating tensions with the Muslim community and then framing themselves as the only party that will destroy this self-created problem, this self-created enemy.
Mr. Hussain, would you hold the Narendra Modi-led Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi responsible for empowering these Hindu supremacist vigilante groups?
I hold Narendra Modi responsible for basically continuing the policy that he started as a governor of Gujarat in 2002, when he basically instigated a pogrom that led to the death of 2,000 Muslims, led to the rape and the destruction of lives of countless others, because this is how he works. This is how he works. He makes his rich friends richer, and he scapegoats Muslims and distracts his poverty-stricken voters and supporters by blaming Muslims. But I also hold responsible the Muslim global community for allowing our leaders to greet people like Modi like a bigger brother, to quote a certain Muslim leader. Muslims need to be organized behind campaigns against people like Modi and join organizations like MPAC UK.
Now let's take a look at what the global media has to say about this situation.
Every Friday for months, members of Hindu vigilante groups, alongside local residents, have been gathering, occasionally armed with axes and wooden rods, at the sites of namaz to try to stop them happening. Slogans including "shoot the traitors" have been shouted, and Hindu prayers and songs read out to try to drown out Quran readings. Cow dung has been placed at the sites, and police have regularly had to hold back the mob so namaz could continue. In Gurgaon, for the past 3 years, Muslims have been pushed out of those common or public spaces where they used to gather on Fridays for their customary collective namaz. Their number in Gurgaon is approximately 5 lakh, and nearly a lakh of them, men to be exact, are out in the day for their work on different locations. There are only 13 mosques in Gurgaon. Muslims have an obligation to offer this collective congregational prayer on Fridays, and it is mostly a half an hour affair.